The Volume.
Jenkins and Jones is brought to you by FanDuel. It's never been easier to play fantasy on FanDuel. Whether you love basketball, golf, soccer, or any other fantasy sport, there's a contest for every fan. FanDuel, more ways to win. Welcome to Jenkins and Jones on the Volume Podcast Network. It is Thursday, October 14th, and here on the eve of the NBA season, we have a very special episode that is mostly a very long, extensive interview with Clint Smith, who wrote How the Word Is Passed, which we just finished reading as our second book for this year's book club. Great interview. I think, you know, maybe the best interview we've had on the podcast. You definitely need to check that out. As always, Jenkins and Jones, hosted by my good internet slash real life buddies, LeJethro Jenkins, a.k.a. John.
What's up, Bubbas?
Dragonfly Jones, a.k.a. Tyler.
Hey, everybody, all the good?
And I'm Guardy B, a.k.a. Mike. Yes, we're recording that. We did the interview with Clint first, so we're all a little bit, like, spaced out.
That dude was amazing,
interview.
Bro.
It was a great interview.
How, you know me? How did he make it to us? Thank God for that, though.
Yeah, shouts to Clint, man.
Let's start. We'll do some sports stuff up top and then get to the interview and maybe talk about that for a second afterwards. But first of all, obviously, the off season that would never end for basketball fans with Kyrie Irving has continued. The Nets did what I think was the right thing in saying they're not going to use the Kyrie loophole that they asked New York to create for Kyrie. And they're now saying he needs to be able to be a, quote, full participant in order to be a member of the team. You know, shout out, first of all, just to everyone in Brooklyn and New York who people who are not engaged in politics, I think, made it clear to the Nets that this was fucked up and that, you know, their players should not be getting loopholes that they don't have in their lives. And respect to them for doing that, because who knows where we'd be if they hadn't. But what was your guys' reaction to this news?
Okay, so we had a discussion a few weeks back when this Kyrie news first broke about how narcissism is the moral compass guiding Kyrie through this whole situation. And I want to come back to that because I think that these recent developments that we got from that article from Shams further affirm that. Like, you know, we discuss how you have to be a narcissist if you think so highly of yourself that you genuinely believe that you are more informed on these matters than medical experts who have devoted their entire lives to this field just because you did like 2 hours of research on YouTube, right? And we were talking in the group chat and you know, I mentioned how there's no telling what Kyrie's destination is with all this. We don't know. I don't even think Kyrie knows, but we do know the goal of all of this. And I think his goal is to be admired by the masses because that's what narcissists seek. Because, you know, the thing about narcissists is no matter how much shit they talk about how they march to their own drum or how they don't bow to the crowd or how they're the lone alpha wolf or whatever the fuck, they want to be admired. And they feel that they're owed admiration because they believe everyone should think as highly of them as they think of themselves. And this is exhibit fucking A of that from Kyrie right here. You know, he is someone who, like I said, he might posture like he doesn't give a shit about what people think about him, but he absolutely does. And that's who he plays to. That's who he's always played to. Like, you take a look at some of the previous stands that he took, right? Like, he railed against the media, got a ton of support for that. You know what I'm saying? The crowd went wild. He took time off when he saw fit, got a ton of support for that too. You know what I'm saying? The crowd went wild. He pulled this anti-vax shit and got booed off the stage, bro. That heat check ain't dropped. You know what I'm saying? And now he's desperately trying to win the crowd back. And, you know, because you're telling me when that Rolling Stone piece first dropped and your aunt went on record, bro, saying that you didn't trust the science of this vaccine. And now all of a sudden, when the big, bad, heartless corporate machine that is the Brooklyn Nets puts their foot down on little old Kyrie, now you're switching your tune and saying you're the voice of the little guy now. Now it was never about the science. You're going to bat for the working man. I ain't buying it, bro. Like I said, Kyrie is desperately trying to win the crowd back here and sway public favor back his way after this heat check ain't dropped. And, you know, like I said, we're all confused on Kyrie's destination. We talked about how he's a contrarian without a cause, which very well might be true. But I think it might be a bit deeper than that. I think he's because right now he's looking like a martyr who's looking for a cross to nail himself to. And he might have found it with this vaccine situation. So time will tell. We'll see, bro.
We booed that nigga. A lot of people didn't boo that nigga, though. You know what I mean? I wouldn't say got booed off the stage. Like, there's a lot of people that are really supporting this man. You know what I'm saying?
It's not and the people he thought, though. Not it's the people who didn't like that he took time off. Because not everyone was celebrating him taking time off, too, right? But his people, our people, the people who listen to our show, were celebrating it. Those people are not celebrating this. Ted Cruz is celebrating this.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if... We talked about this in a group chat. No, I agree he's a narcissist. I think it comes from a sick place. I tweeted that I think it's more he feels like he's MLK is more reminiscent of Kanye to me. You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? There's narcissism there, but there's really no purpose. So that's where I don't know if he's trying. I just think he's a sick man. You know what I mean? That doesn't have any real purpose. I do think he's a narcissist. I think he's contrarian. But I think that's a result of like a sickness, man. You know what I mean? And what I'm tripping off of is like, dude, like I was talking to my homie that has, you know, insight to the situation that I don't and most people don't, right? And he was saying that this was with this situation with them not letting him play, period, that wasn't just a team decision, that was a KD decision. You know what I mean? And for that man to make that decision makes me wonder how Kyrie's truly going to respond to that. You know, like you said, he may potentially, you know, be like, all right, you know, it was cool. But I think there's a good chance that he's not. He's like, fuck it, because that man does not like being told what to do. You know what I mean? As a result of all the things I listed earlier. And we might not see Kyrie play basketball again. That is fully on the table right now. And that is wild to me. You know what I mean? And also – something that you thought a long time ago, so maybe you're more prepared for it than I was. But this is crazy. That's a wild thought that Kyrie.
I ask on Twitter, was Tyler's 2000 prediction 2 years ago that Kyrie was going to retire at 29, which is the age he is now, to start an alpaca farm? Was that a prediction or a curse?
Only thing we missing is the alpacas. We'll see, bro. Kyrie gonna goddamn be a contrarian and get some llamas instead, knowing that motherfucker. But.
Nigga Diamond strikes again, dog. You know what I mean? You said it, but it's wild to see. It's wild to see. But I was like, in the tweet that I tweeted, I saw a lot of back people that there was laughter, obviously, but there was a lot of people going crazy as well, and they're like coming at me, and I'm like. So, like, that booing shit, yeah, you know, there was some boos, but a lot of niggas is fucking with him and looking at him in the way that he looks at himself. So, that support might, you know, might get him, think he has this, you know, he swayed enough people. I don't know, man, but I don't see him backing down from this at this point.
The other big sports story of the week, John Gruden had a series of emails in an investigation into the Washington football team's misconduct. Emails that John Gruden had sent while he was an ESPN employee that included homophobic slurs, had included racial comments about D. Smith and his lips, which seemed to have been something that was going to be forgiven until this sort of other stuff came out. Not forgiven by us, John, but forgiven by the media or
I hear you.
You know,
it's just
his employer
sick,
or whatever.
Yeah,
it didn't, no, 100%. And I think this gets to the heart of a lot of people who said this, but I think this gets to the heart of something that you guys have talked about a lot on this podcast. You feel like a lot of coaches are writing, a lot of people writing emails like this or sending texts like this or making comments like this on fucking phone calls with their friends. John Gruden, we really learn is that John Gruden is stupid enough to put this
stupid
shit in a work
fuck.
Email, yes. Right? So, I don't know. What was your reaction, Tyler?
Okay, so, you know, going off what you said about how John Gruden was not only a bigot, but a fucking idiotic bigot, right? Like, that's kind of where I'm at with it. You know, John Gruden, you know, he's not the first to be exposed for saying some bigoted, racist, homophobic shit. He won't be the last, but every single time this happens, there's always a very vocal crowd, right? A very vocal crowd asking everyone to look past all the bigotry on display. And, you know, they've always got excuses. They've always got excuses for why we should. You know, they never come flat out and say, you know, I'm okay with bigotry. We all know that's their stance. You know what I'm saying? When they go to bat for these exposed bigots, but they never come out and say it. You know, instead they try to offer these excuses for why we should look past the bigotry at hand by trying to flip the narrative, by trying to, you know, flip the narrative on some redemption arc shit or some growth shit. That was 10 years ago. He's grown since then. You know, they don't even know these motherfuckers, but they're telling us they've grown, right? Or by, like, you know, attempting to minimize it. It was a private conversation. What if everyone heard your private conversations? Like I said, we never hear them come flat out and say, I support bigotry and I support this bigot being bigoted. Even though we all know that's truly their stance with these flimsy ass arguments. You know, they flip the whole fucking narrative upside down and frame the bigot as the victim while having zero regard for the people the victim targeted, the bigot targeted. But in this situation with Gruden, with all the bigotry, all the racism, all the homophobia on display, despite all that, we saw a fucking masterclass of stupidity put on full display. Bro, Gruden used his company email to say these things. His company email.
To use the F slur, bro.
Right. He used his company email.
JGruden@ESPN.com.
Right. He used his company email to call the commissioner of the NFL a homophobic slur. He used his company email to say racist things about the president of the Players Association. If you don't think the sheer utter stupidity that was on full display here was a fireable offense, then you're telling on yourself, bro. You're telling on yourself even more than you normally would do as a bigotry apologist because of the unprecedented level of stupidity on Gruden's part here. You're finally saying the quiet part out loud. If you're saying that Gruden didn't deserve to get fired here, that being stupid enough to use your company email to spew bigotry about prominent members in your company is a fireable offense, right? Then you're finally saying the quiet part out loud, bro. You're saying there will never be an instance when bigotry is unacceptable for you. You're riding for bigotry at all times, even if it's carried out in the most fucking stupid, idiotic ways. You're not going to bat for the right to grow. You're not going to bat for the sanctity of privacy. You never were. You're going to bat for bigotry, and you always were. And I wish these people would just come out and say that when shit like this happens and stop playing in our fucking face about it.
What's wild to me is the motherfuckers that look like you and me that are supporting this motherfucker. You know what I mean?
Looking and, like Sam Jackson hugging Leo on goddamn Django right about now. The fuck?
That's wild to me. And we look at bigots or racists as sworn enemies. But a lot of, you know, let's keep it a stack. A lot of people, you know what I'm saying, that look like me and you, their politics align in a lot of ways with motherfuckers who they swore as enemies. You know what I mean? Like for a motherfucker look like me to support that type of shit, dog. You know what I mean? Couldn't be me, nigga. You know what I mean?
Could not be me.
But that's what's wild to me is like, you know, like we don't like how a man could say that type of shit, and we find ways to. I question how this affects society. Us looking at everybody's nigga. What the. My shit ain't got none of that in that motherfucking nigga. You know what I mean? Especially not on a work email. You feel what I'm saying? Like, bro,
I think you can acknowledge that there's a difference between public and private communication while not saying private communication.
It's the reason you can say whatever you want to say. What's wrong in this situation? It's not the invasion of privacy is what was said, nigga. Like, you know what I'm saying?
But it's like we might make we made plenty of jokes in the group chat that we would not make on the podcast. We've not called someone the F slur in the fucking group chat.
Flat out.
But that's the thing. All these situations, as Tyler said, bring out the people beating the drum, just chanting, "Whom among us? Whom among us?
And among
us. Raise your hand.
Done none
us,
of that shit, bro.
Us among us. You know what 100%. Like, we're over here casting stones like a motherfucker.
It's crazy. Like, who hasn't said, bro, no, bro. Like, you know, maybe as a kid when I didn't know, as soon as I had some sense, it's like, I don't ever use the F word ever. And it's so fucking easy. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know, I remember when they first had the NBA joint, when they were like, you know, calling somebody gay as a joke was lame. And I remember looking at that shit like, shut the fuck up. I don't call nobody none of that shit no more, bro. Even in jest, and it's not difficult. You know what I mean? If it's hard for you not to say that shit, it's a problem with you, nigga.
Keep that to yourself.
It's not society. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
It's not society's
change and we're so soft. Motherfucker, you have the problem, dog. Flat out.
Yeah, it's been so wild seeing like a major defensive this being like, oh come on, y'all aren't racist in your email?
No,
no motherfucker, we're not. No! The no! fuck,
homophobic? Right? No,
right. What the fuck? And look, and I'm gonna keep it a buck. I don't give a fuck about, you know. First of all, it's not privacy on a company email. You know what
Period.
I'm saying? And we should, right? If you are
for the biggest email, media company in the world. Right. By the way.
Exactly. ESPN and NFL emails interacting back and forth. What the fuck? They ain't shit private about that, bro. And we should make motherfuckers be afraid to say this shit on big enough platforms like
Period.
That. Bro, if you want to be a racist, I want you to fucking form a secret society where you got to whisper every third full moon on your meetings about how much you
right.
hate Mexicans, bro. I don't want you, right? I don't give a fuck about your right to fucking spew
the
big
third
fuck
fortnight
fuck
of the week. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
The third yeah. fortnight of the year we get together and fucking shit. You know, fuck out of yeah. with this shit, man. I think no, fuck all of that and fuck anybody supporting any of that shit. I do not agree with none of that bullshit.
I will never understand people measuring how progressive a society is by how tolerant it is of bigotry. I'm on the complete opposite end of that spectrum. I measure how progressive a society is by how intolerant of bigotry they are. Flat out.
Bloop. Bitch ass nigga. Fuck nigga.
Google that, fuck nigga.
Google that, fuck nigga. You know what I'm saying? Hey, and let me say this real quick before we hop off this bitch. Don't ever come to my motherfucking
off.
Family's motherfucking bloodline, bitch ass nigga. You Talk know what I'm saying? Them. I just brought up two of my uncles. You feel me? You can write a fucking book of my mom. My dad could be a motherfucking blockbuster motherfucking movie. I'm the lamest motherfucker in my motherfucking family, bitch. And I will dog walk your ass on my motherfucking bloodline, motherfucker. Fuck you mean? It's on site. If I ain't with my motherfucking daughter and my wife, I'm slapping fire out that bitch ass nigga. And I hope you try me. I don't play that shit, nigga. I'm a country ass nigga from St. Louis, bitch. The descendant of motherfucking slaves, nigga. I come from motherfucking perseverance, bitch ass nigga. Fuck you mean? I got real serious for a second, but I got that shit made me mad. Don't ever come from my motherfucking bloodline, motherfucker. Shit. Can't believe he tried me like that. I was scorching hot on motherfucking ride to work, nigga. I had to pull over and get that fucking tweet off. You feel me? Bitch ass. I'm like, nigga, you talk about me all you want. You might be right, because I'm a fucking podcaster, bitch. You know what I mean? I ain't shit. You feel me? You might be right, but when you talking about my family, you don't know, nigga. And my best friend is in the motherfucking Smithsonian. You couldn't walk at night where he fucking grew up, bitch. And that's where my motherfucking family from. Don't ever come from my motherfucking people, bitch. Nigga, don't ever
Talk
fucking yo, don't get nigga, dog. If you see me with a nigga, dog, know he a real one. Fuck, nigga. I'm the lamest nigga I know. Flat the fuck out. Flat the fuck out. Don't ever try nobody I'm fucking with. Nigga, shit. I'll get my cousin Portia. She will dog walk your ass, bitch. You feel me? She will drag your ass all up in James Cool, which is a street that my other uncle, Norman Say, motherfucking got named after James Cool, bitch. You know what I'm saying? Right down from Dorman Say's motherfucking park. It's named after him. You feel me? Don't come with me. Come for me, nigga. Shit. Actually, come for me. Don't come with my motherfucking people, though. Flat the fuck out. No, I don't play that shit.
All right. Stay tuned for our in-depth interview with Clint Smith, number one New York Times bestseller, right after the break. FanDuel Sportsbook wants you to get the most out of every NFL game day. That's why they're giving everyone a $10 risk-free bet every week. All you have to do is bet a same-game parlay bet with three legs or more, and if your bet doesn't win, FanDuel will pay you back up to $10. This week, we've got the Cardinals and the Rams. I despise both of these teams, but I despise the Cardinals slightly less, so I'll be making a same-game parlay with the Cardinals to win. Kyler Murray's rushing and passing props and the Cardinals' total points on the over, and I'll get better odds than I would have by taking Cardinals spread or money line. But same-game parlays are not the only reason I love betting on all the NFL action with FanDuel Sportsbook. They've also got fast payouts. It's easy to use. They're safe and secure. It's America's number one sportsbook. There's no feeling like nailing a same-game parlay bet, so lock in your bet today on FanDuel Sportsbook and get up to $10 back if your bet doesn't win. New to FanDuel Sportsbook, they're also offering a risk-free $1,000 bet if you prefer that. Just sign up with promo code JANJ, that's J&J, and if your first bet loses, you get up to $1,000 back in site credit. That's promo code JANJ. Disclaimer, must be 21 and over and present in Arizona, Colorado, Indiana, Michigan, New Jersey, Tennessee, Virginia, or West Virginia. Refund issued as non-withdrawable site credit that expires in 7 days. Max refund $10. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Same game parlay available for multiple sports in all states on mobile/web. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. We're excited to welcome on our guest, Clint Smith. We just spent the last couple of weeks reading his book, How the Word Is Passed. And Clint, thank you so much. We're honored that you joined us, man. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's good to be here. This is like one of those long-time listener, first-time caller kind of things.
That's wild. It's crazy that Clint is a fan, bro. Like, this, bro, New York Times, number one bestseller. Is listening to our foolishness. Like, I'm
wasting his time listening to us make fun of Tom Cruise.
Saying Tom Cruise looks like a cashew and shit. But for sure. But Clint, man, for sure, I appreciate you having us on. You know, we've been Twitter homies for a minute. It's good to finally connect on the Zoom and shit. So, you know, the book, How the Word Is Passed, incredible read, you know, as we were going through it on the book club, just phenomenal. I guess my first question would be, like, what was the inspiration for that? You know, it's a book about reckoning with America's past, which is something America's always been doing. It seems America always will be doing. It seems that shit has kind of kicked into overdrive like the last 10 years or so, though. So was there like a light bulb moment when you had this idea, or was it just kind of like a culmination, like a slow burn of when the idea came to you?
Yeah, I think it's been a little bit of both. I mean, obviously, over the course of the past several years, we've had the Black Lives Matter movement that's sort of pushed the country's public consciousness around issues of race and racism and history in directions that it certainly hasn't gone in my lifetime. And part of what happened was in 2015, there was the massacre in the Charleston church, and that was, and then Bree Newsom took down the Confederate flag in front of the Charleston Capitol. And that's when we started having this conversation around Confederate iconography and statues and flags. And we saw dozens of statues come down in different cities across the country. We saw different states take down the Confederate flag from in front of their in front of the state buildings. And New Orleans, my hometown, was having its own conversation around this. And ultimately, the city council and the mayor decided that we were going to remove several Confederate statues that had been just like central to the iconography of the city, or central to the landscape of the city. And these were statues of P.G.T. Beauregard, Robert E. Lee, Jefferson Davis, these leaders of the Confederacy, two generals and a president. And it took 2 years for them to come down because they were being threatened. The contractors were being threatened by white supremacists and neo-Nazis and neo-Confederates every time they would get the contract to be the person or to be the organization that removed the statues. And people, I mean, it got wild. People's cars were blown up. I mean, they were committed to preventing this from happening at all costs. And it was so eerily reminiscent of the terror tactics that the White League and the Ku Klux Klan used throughout the early 20th century in order to prevent, you know, Black folks from going to white schools, Black folks from doing, having access to all sort of social and material capital. So, May 2017, the statues finally come down, and I'm watching. I live in Maryland now. I'm watching via live stream as these statues that were so central to my childhood and again, the landscape of the city, watching these statues come down. And I was like, well, what does it mean that I grew up in a majority Black city in which there were more homages to enslavers than there were to enslaved mm-hmm. people? And what does that mean? What does it mean that to get to school, I had to go down Robert E. Lee Boulevard? To get to the grocery store, I had to go down Jefferson Davis Parkway, that my middle school was named after a leader of the Confederacy, that my parents still live on a street today named after somebody who owned over 150 enslaved people. And, you know, we know that symbols and names and iconography aren't just symbols. They're reflective of the stories that people tell. And those stories shape the narratives that communities carry. And those narratives shape public policy. And public policy shapes the material conditions of people's lives. And that's not to say that taking down a 60-foot tall statue of Robert E. Lee is gonna suddenly erase the racial wealth gap. Mm-hmm. But it is to say that all of these images and symbols shape how we understand the history of this country, and thus how we understand the sort of amends that this country needs to make for the harm that it has caused to different groups of people. And so I was thinking about these statues, I was thinking about them coming down, and I was like, well, how does my own city talk about or fail to talk about its own relationship to this history in a city where the levees and the roads and the buildings were all built by enslaved people, and this place that is surrounded by plantations that don't mention enslaved people at all. And so I started thinking about historical sites and places around New Orleans that were or weren't telling these stories, and then kind of just broadened it out and started thinking about, well, how do different places across this country tell this story or fail to tell this story? I kind of went on this 4-year journey that brought me here.
You touched on that a little bit during a prologue. I read that because I'm normally anti-prologue and anti-epilogue, but my friends right. called me out on that shit. anyway,
John had never read an epilogue before
in
your
my
epilogue.
Life.
Listen, quick. We were talking about, you know, how we were going to discuss the last few chapters and then the epilogue. And John pulled up, man, we don't need to discuss the epilogue. We can discuss that with him. We was like, bro, you did not read the epilogue if you're saying that, right?
Okay.
Right?
Because the epilogue hit
me and Mike harder than like any part of that book, man. And we appreciate you sharing that with us for real.
Right. But then I did read it. And it made me go back to the prologue, and that's how I know you touched on that in the prologue. But what I'm saying is, how important was it to have those conversations with your grandmother, your grandparents? Because that was the hardest, that hit me harder than any other part too as well. Like the part she was talking about, what she lived in and how that hit you. Like, how important were these conversations you had with them?
Yeah, I mean, they were everything. I mean, I think I spent all these years interviewing people who were strangers, right? And asking strangers to tell me their life stories and asking strangers to tell me all these like intimate parts of their lives and how this history impacted them. And I kind of had this moment where I was like, I'm asking strangers all these like deep and personal and intimate questions in a way that I've never asked my own family, right? I think you go to Thanksgiving, especially now I got kids, I got a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, and you show up at Thanksgiving and like, you could barely have a conversation with anybody about, you know, past the turkey leg because your 2-year-old is like throwing macaroni in your face and your 2-year-old is like, I got to poop. And so, I was like, I need to create a scenario in which I can like sit and have this conversation with my grandparents in a way that's going to allow me to dig a little deeper than I've dug with them before. And the catalyst for that was that we went to the National Museum of African American History and Culture, like I talked about in the epilogue. And we were walking around and I was pushing my grandfather in the wheelchair. My grandmother was walking a little bit ahead of us. And I was just looking around and I was like, man, so much of the history that is documented in this museum, like they lived through, mm-hmm. you know, my grandfather born in 1930, Jim Crow, Mississippi, and my grandmother born in 1939, Jim Crow, Florida, their proximity to this history is so close in ways that I think I always knew in the abstract, but like, had never really fully understood. And the moment where it became really clear was when we were going to, we passed Emmett Till's casket mm-hmm. and I was pushing my grandfather in the wheelchair. And he was just like, you know, that happened like a few miles down the road from where me and your grandmother lived. And I was like, man, my grandfather could have been Emmett Till, you know, and I think part of what happens is so much of this type of history we tell ourselves was a long time ago when it wasn't that long ago at all. And you know, I remember the moment where I, you know, was talking to my grandfather and I was like, man, my grandfather's grandfather was enslaved. Yeah. The woman who opened the National Museum of African American History and Culture, the building we were in 2016, was the daughter of an enslaved person. Like not the granddaughter, the great granddaughter, this woman who rang the bell to open the museum with the Obama family in 2016 is the daughter of someone born into intergenerational chattel slavery. I just did an NPR show the other day where a woman called in, I think she was like 70 years old, and she was talking about how she was raised by her great grandfather and she called him Pappy. She was like, yeah, I was raised by Pappy and Pappy was born a slave, still had the marks on his back, right? So there are people who are alive today who were loved by, raised by, in community with people who were born into bondage. And so the idea that someone would suggest that history has nothing to do with what the contemporary landscape of inequality looks like is so morally and intellectually disingenuous. And I think that this book, in the process of writing this book, in the process of finishing with conversations with my grandparents, not only gave me a sense of my physical proximity to this history with all the places, but also like our temporal proximity, mm-hmm. right? That slavery exists for 250 years, only hasn't existed for a little over 150. Mm-hmm. So you have this institution that existed for 100 years longer than it hasn't. And then people want to be like, that has nothing to do with what our world looks like today, when it has everything to do mm-hmm. with what our society looks like today.
I want to add, this is a bit of a pivot, and I apologize for that, but I wanted to just ask you, from a writer's perspective, how you kind of arrived at the structure to focus on, as you said, to tell the story geographically. And I think certainly in places, you know, I'm sure a lot of people who pick the book up are surprised to see New York City, right? Are surprised to see the places that you went to tell this story. And then I was also really, I don't think in 100 years I would have thought of telling this story through interviewing these tour guides and the people who are engaged in the kind of oral history of, you know, talking about these sites. So can you sort of talk about how you came to that decision to structure the book that way and then, you know, give it their perspective?
Yeah, it was a process. I mean, it was so, you know, I came into writing as a poet. And so my first book was a collection of poetry, came out in 2016. And when I was watching the statues come down, I initially was thinking that it would be my second book of poetry and that I would write a book of poems in which the conceit was that every poem was about a specific statue in New Orleans. And that's how it kind of started, because poems are like the creation of art, but they're also the mechanism by which I do my best thinking.
If I
think through poems.
If I can interject here, the fact that you are a poetry shined in a very favorable way in this book. Like the way you would describe things, it was like, yeah, this dude is a poet. You know what I mean? So yeah, I just want to give you that compliment there.
I appreciate it. Yeah, no, thank you. And I think what poetry does is it teaches me to pay attention, right? Like in poetry, part of what you're doing is focusing on a moment or an idea or an image, and you're trying to home in on it as closely as you can. And like no detail is too microscopic. No detail is too granular. And so like when I'm going to these places, I want to get a sense of the sort of texture of it, right? And the sensory detail. I want it to feel cinematic almost. Like I want you to feel like you are standing there right next to me. What does it smell like? What does it look like? What does the air taste like? What is, you know, who are these people? What are they wearing? What are their faces doing? What are their voices sound like? What do they remind me of? You know, part of it is going back a little bit. So I thought I was going to write these poems, and then I realized the book needed to be a little more expansive than that, and that it shouldn't also just include my voice, but also had to include the voices of other people. So I remember when I went to Monticello, which is the first chapter in the book, and I was on this tour and David was giving this masterclass of like the cognitive dissonance of Thomas Jefferson and who Jefferson was as an enslaver and the story we don't often tell about him. And I remember I was watching these two women, Donna and Grace, who were on the tour with me, and I went up and afterwards I went up to them and asked them, you know, how did you experience everything that David was saying? Cause like while we were watching or listening to David, their mouths were agape. Like they looked shocked. They were sweating. They looked stressed. And I remember I went up to them and she, as it says in the book, Donald's like, man, he really took the shine off the guy. I had no idea Jefferson owned slaves.
We talked a lot about that passage, about the phrase "took the shine off of him." It was such a fascinating phrase.
You got to remember that these are people who bought plane tickets, who rented cars, who got a hotel room to come to the home of Thomas Jefferson as almost a pilgrimage, and had no idea that he was a person who owned over 600 people. Had no idea that he had that he enslaved his own children, right? Had no conception of Monticello as a plantation. And I think that moment, like going up to them and having that conversation, was really transformative for what the structure of the book would be, because I realized that I had to incorporate the perspectives and voices of a wide range of other people if I was really gonna get a sense of like the plurality of ways that slavery is understood or misunderstood in this country. Because the thing is, it's funny, like now you read all the reviews and stuff and everybody's like, the narrative is like poet and journalist Clint Smith goes on this journey, da da da. But like, I work at The Atlantic now, but I got that job after I finished the book. So I had no conception of myself as a journalist. Like the idea of going up to white people on a plantation and asking them what they think about slavery is like not part of my ethos at all. Like that is not a natural disposition for me.
Right.
And I had to really like pump myself up. I was like, all right, like we're going to do this. We're going to go like ask these people what they think. But it really showed me the power of that sort of reporting, in this sort of context. And that is what I tried to do at each of the places that I went, because I think it added, if it was just me reflecting on my own experience there. I mean, I'm not Hanif, right? So like Hanif, you know, I think Hanif can not talk to anybody and just give us the interiority of his thoughts. And you're like, damn, like, and then he wins a MacArthur, right? Like, so,
yeah, he's cold as hell,
cold man.
But like, that's a cold. I think for the rest of us, we got, you know, it's important, I think, to, and for the project of what this book was trying to accomplish, it had to have those other voices in it, the docents, the public historians, the visitors, all these folks, and then put to those reactions and responses in conversation with my own reflections and experiences in these places.
Gotcha. But you made a great point. The last comment I just want to make about it, you made a great point. It's like, I don't think we consider public docents at historical sites to be like an important cultural force in America, but they talk to way more people than almost any author. Every year, man. Right? I thought that was a really fascinating point. That really is how we're telling these stories. A teacher talks to 30 kids, a successful author is talking to 50, 100,000 people, but a couple million people go through some of these sites every year.
Yeah, you know? I mean, that's the thing for me is that like they encounter, I don't remember the exact numbers, but like 500,000 people before the pandemic like went to Monticello every year. I think it might be more than that. And like there's no book about slavery that 500,000 people are reading every year.
Right.
Like that's not how it goes. And so they are encountering people who would otherwise, they're encountering more people, and they're also encountering people who would never pick up the book itself. Right. Like David regularly encounters people who would never like be inclined to go order a copy of How the Word is Passed on their own. Maybe after they talk to him, but like, you meet a lot of people like Donna and Grace, right? Who show up and think they're coming to see one thing and then realize that they're coming to see something that is much more expansive and complicated in some ways and complex than what they initially came for. And so, I mean, I think that the docents, and part of what I tried to replicate in the spirit of the book, is that there's this really incredible ability to find a balance between like generosity and grace, and like extending graciousness to people in the sense that like, we're not going to judge you for what you don't know when you show up here. But at the same time, there's a level of like accountability and responsibility, mm-hmm. where it's like, we're not going to judge you for what you don't know. But once we present that information to you, you have a responsibility to sit with that, right? You can't run from that. You can't pretend like, you know, I'm saying something that I'm not. And I think that is what they, whether it's David at Monticello or Yvonne at Whitney or Damaris in New York, like so many of these folks do such a good job of saying, of sort of pulling people in and inviting them in to a conversation and a space and a set of ideas that they may have never encountered. And also saying, all right, now you got to sit with it. And that's hard. And it's hard to varying degrees for different people, but, I think it's just so effective in the way that they do it.
Sure.
So, Tyler, go ahead.
No,
go ahead.
I was going to say, so, you know, building on what you've just said here, like an overarching theme of this book seemed to be dismantling the notion of how judging the atrocities of the past through the moral lens of today is a flawed way to go about things. Like we hear that all the time when people discuss slavery. You know, there's people who are like, well, you can't judge the atrocities committed hundreds of years ago through a 21st century lens. And I've always thought that was bullshit for a number of reasons, because one, slavery, for instance, was always controversial. It was never universally accepted. There was always a tide of, you know, like anti-slavery sentiment, and slave owners themselves even grappled with and attempted to, you know, rationalize, you know, the atrocities that they themselves committed. And two, I feel like that line of thinking totally disregards the people on the receiving end of these atrocities. Mm. You know, it totally discounts any racism. In an attempt to mitigate the harm that these, you know, historical figures inflicted on others in the past, we are silencing their victims once again when we do this. You know, we're making the people on the receiving end of these atrocities silence again, like just doubling down on their, you know, dehumanizing. And you know, because I promise you, the enslaved people who are being brutalized by Robert E. Lee were not conflicted in their views of him. You know what I'm saying? I'm sure they just flat out viewed him as a very, very cruel and evil man, which is why I never liked that line of thinking. I always thought it was a cop out. You know, we can't sanitize history. We have to take it in, warts and all. And that brings me to my question here. You know, you were, you know, the man on the ground, you know, interacting with people who are getting these hard dosages of truth. Some, you know, accepted it. Some were still in denial. But being an educator, like, how has your reaction, how have the reactions been when you are teaching, you know, the unsanitized, truthful history there? Like, have you gotten any pushback from students, staffs, parents? Or I'm just interested in how that all gets ingested.
Yeah, I mean, it probably depends on the context. I've taught at a lot of different levels now. Like, I was a high school English teacher. Then I was teaching when I was a PhD student. I was teaching master students. I've been teaching in prisons and jails for a long time. And I think the thing that I encounter most of the time is that, especially when I'm teaching primarily Black and Brown students, is that our young people, and or really anyone, but especially our young people, are rarely taught information that helps them provide context to the communities that they live in. And so I think about a moment all the time. I've been teaching, I haven't since the pandemic, but hopefully we'll be back in there soon, but was teaching at DC jail. And there's a book, The Color of Law by Richard Rothstein. What about the history of housing segregation in the United States, and how state-sponsored housing segregation contributed to the wealth gap and, you know, so much of the inequality we see today. And I remember one of my students, young man, just like 19 years old in the jail, we weren't even reading that book as a group. He found that book in the library on his own. And I remember we had a conversation about it, and he was just like, Clint, like, nobody ever talked to us about this. Like, nobody ever told us this. We grew up thinking that this was our fault, right? We grew up thinking that this community, that our houses, that our neighborhood looked the way that it did because we didn't do something or we did something wrong. And no one had ever given him the context to show that, like, the reason one community in DC looks one way and another community in DC looks another way is not because the people in those communities, but because of what has been done to those communities generation after generation after generation. And that's not to say that people who are on the receiving end of that don't have agency, right, and can't escape from those circumstances. But it is to provide important context that helps him understand how he ended up in the circumstances that he's in, right? Like, when you understand how the history of state-sanctioned segregation and racism made your community look the way that it did, and made sure that your parents, you know, weren't able to move to certain neighborhoods or couldn't get certain jobs, or that your grandparents, you know, were never able to buy a home and could only rent, so never had the equity that accrued over time, and all of these different things, then you begin to understand your own situation in a different way. And you don't think that you ended up in jail singularly because you are a bad person, or there's something wrong with you, or there's something wrong with the place you come from. But you understand it as part of a larger set of forces that may have put you in a position of desperation, or may have put you in a position of distress, may have continued to inflict like physical and psychological trauma on you throughout your childhood that can't be disentangled from the position you find yourself in now. And that's so freeing to people, right? Because all the like folks in jail, or even folks not in jail, like, are inundated with these messages about how whatever happens to you is because of what you did, or whatever happened to you is because of what you didn't do. And I think there's something to be said for whether it's in the context of mass incarceration or slavery or Jim Crow, whatever we're trying to teach about, there's something to be said for providing young people with the language and the toolkit to push back against so many of these narratives that they're on the receiving end of. And I think that I remember when I, you know, growing up in New Orleans, I felt that too. There was a sort of paralysis. It was a sort of emotional and psychological paralysis, because you're told all these things that are wrong with New Orleans, wrong with Black people, wrong with the community that you come from. And then you learn American history and you realize that so much of what you've been told is a lie. Mm. And that has been freeing and liberating for me, and I know freeing and liberating for so many of my students in ways that, you know, can't even really be quantified.
Tyler talked about you being a poet shining through. You talked about being a poet. We talked about how you being a poet, like, balanced out some of the heaviness of the book. But there were times where we talked about the courthouse where the lady had to get the slave had to give up her child, infant child, and how she pleaded to a god she didn't even know existed, you know what I mean, because that's all she could do, you know, the system supported this atrocity, you know what I mean. But I had to put the book down and go for a walk. Like, you're the vessel this is coming from, though. Like, you know, how do you describe the process of writing these things? How do you balance out these emotions that I'm imagining you're going through while sharing these, you know, difficult stories, but important stories to hear?
Yeah, I mean, I think that part of it, I mean, you know, as a writer, strategically, I think you just have to be mindful of when and how you insert certain types of information, right? And when you give the reader a second to take a breath, like, and when you give the reader a moment to sort of step back, because if you're just inundating them with traumatic images and traumatic descriptions over and over again, and that's all 300 pages of your book, that's going to be hard for people to digest. That's going to be hard for people to engage with. But I think, you know, what the best writers I know who write on difficult subjects do is they find a way to achieve a level of balance, right? Where they, you know, maybe they're describing something and then they step back a little bit to contextualize it. Or maybe, you know, in the context of this book, part of what was really important for me, and this kind of goes back to the question about, you know, structure and form, what I wanted to do was write a book of history that felt like a novel. Like, I wanted it to feel literary. I wanted it to feel like someone was on a narrative journey. And in doing so, in this context, that means I was the protagonist of the story, right? That you were kind of following me on my journey across the country and across the ocean to discover and make sense of these places. And so, you know, if I'm telling this first person story and I'm the protagonist, then I think part of what's important is to provide a level of interiority and you know, honesty from my end. And so that's why it felt important for me, you know, when I see when I'm at the Whitney and see the Field of Angels, right? And I see the dates and the names and of all these children who died in infancy. When I see the body of the infant, of the child in the arms of that angel, the statue of it. For me, those moments, it's not enough for me to just describe what I'm seeing if I'm not also going to share how I'm experiencing that moment. Because I think part of what that also does is gives the reader permission to step back and process how they're experiencing that moment, right? Because if I just went like, look at this, look at this, look at this, and not providing a second to pull back and say, you know, when I see that child in that angel's hands, like, it is impossible for me not to think of my own children. And, you know, and I think I tried to do that in every space that I went to, whether it was the traumatic moments and also the moments where I was learning something I didn't know, right? Because I think part of what was important about this book was not sometimes I think with books on subjects like this, people can encounter information and then feel like they should be ashamed of not knowing it before. But like, this book was written by, you know, the motivation for writing this book was because I didn't know so much, right? Like, I went to these places because I realized that I did not understand the history of slavery in any way that was commensurate with the impact that it had on this country and the way that it continues to shape this country. And so I wanted to also in those moments say, damn, I didn't know this. Or I'm also just realizing this, so that when the reader is having that moment too, they don't feel dumb or they don't feel like they should have known it before. Like, maybe you should have known it before, but maybe I should have known it before too, right? Or maybe we've all been failed by this country that is structurally and systemically failed to provide us with the level of education on the subject matter that we need and deserve. So yeah, it's just, you know, that's a long way of saying I think putting myself in it, mm-hmm. and making sure that my reflections and thoughts and how I'm processing so much of what I was seeing and hearing is part of that also allows a level of respite for the reader to step back and say, like, well, how am I processing and making sense of this?
How did you manage your emotions? So, like, you were learning things for the first time as well, just like, you know, as I was, but you were learning them in the moment, you know, seeing these things in a way that you describe greatly in the book. How did you manage your emotions and then having to relive them by writing about them and sharing them? You know what I mean? How do you manage that?
I mean, I think sometimes it's hard. I think what also happened is that I was writing this book as my wife and I were growing our family. So, you know, my 4-year-old was born the same month that the statues came down. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, and then my 2-year-old was born in the middle of this process. And so part of it is that I go spend the day at, you know, a plantation, and then I come home and I have to pretend to be a brachiosaurus, right? Like, I can't necessarily just sit with it. Like, yeah, I gotta, yeah,
there we go.
So it's interesting, 'cause they are the thing that make it more real, mm-hmm. and more intimate. And also they are the little humans that, like, pull me back, right? And remind me, and sort of give me my own sort of respite, mm-hmm. from having to just sit with that in and of itself. And I don't know what the process of writing this book would have been like if I didn't have that to come back to. 'Cause when you're, you know, when your kids are, you know, what were they, like, 6 months and 2 and then a year and 3, like, you gotta be present. Mm-hmm. And you better be a good brachiosaurus or the T-Rex is going to get you.
There we go. Know,
so.
So I'm a sports writer, not a poet, but I did send an email to a friend of mine, like, 6 months into my wife and I having our first kid. And the subject line of the email was a poem about having children. And the poem was, "This shit is fucking crazy." Like, because you feel like you're walking around with no skin on. You're just like, right? Every emotion is so plugged into you. I wanted to ask you a little bit about audience. Writing poetry or writing a book is such a weird thing because you would never share. You mentioned your ethos is not going up to white people at plantations to ask them how they're feeling, right? I imagine your ethos is also not standing on a corner telling any stranger passing by about these deeply emotional moments and considering your own children in the context of what this country was like for the vast majority of its existence. So how has that been for you? It's obviously a blessing in many ways, I'm sure, that the book has been so successful, but has it been uncomfortable for you sharing these deeply personal moments with some of the people in the book who you would not go up to and share your relationship with your grandparents? Or, you know, I mean, it's number one bestseller, obviously, like, you're at the airport, you are at Ralph's, like, you are in the grocery store, right? Anyone can pick this book up and read this incredibly emotional portrayal of your relationship with your grandparents and your children. So how has that experience been like for you as a person, not as an author?
Yeah, I mean, I think you got to understand that, like, this was never, it's hard to explain how not at all on my radar the possibility of, like, being a number one New York Times bestseller was. I mean, you know, part of it is you go into the publication of a book and you also have to be wary of anything, any external factors shaping how you think about the success of your own book, right? Because I know plenty of folks who wrote amazing books that never made the New York Times bestseller list, or never got a prize, or never, but, and then that, you know, at its worst makes the person feel like their book wasn't a success, even when it's still, like, this deep, moving, beautiful, informative, you know, piece of work. And so I think I was guarding against that a lot. And so when I got a call from my agent and my editor the week after it came out, when the bestseller list came, and they were both just screaming. They were like, you're number one. I, like, fell out of my chair. I was just, like, on the floor. And then my kids are like, oh, we're playing dinosaur. And so, you know,
one up on the brachiosaurus.
Man, yeah, that's the common theme throughout this process is like, you know, when Pops is on the floor, it's dinosaur time. Yeah, I mean, how's it? It's been really amazing. I mean, you know, this book was written for a 15-year-old version of me. Right. Like this book was written. I wanted to write the sort of book that I wish I had been able to read when I was, you know, 15, 16 years old, looking around my city and being like, well, why is there a statue of Robert E. Lee in the middle of this traffic circle? Like, why are we going to IKEA on Jefferson Davis Parkway? Like, why, you know, but I right. never really, right. I never sat with it because we didn't really talk about it. So the first audience is like the younger version of me. And then as we were kind of speaking about, I think like other young Black people who are trying to make sense of their country and their environment and could use some like ammunition, right? Like what is the information that is going to, you know, whether, you know, you can think of it as ammunition or as a shield, right? To shield you against the bullshit that this country inundates you with all the time. And obviously though, I'm thrilled when other people engage with it and read it. And I think the thing about being a writer, whether it's a poem or whether it's a book in nonfiction, is that you never know what people are going to bring to it, right? Like that's part of the thing I love about art. Sometimes when I go do these conversations with, students about like poetry, they'll be like, well, what did you mean in this poem or in this line? Or, and for me, I'm kind of like, it doesn't really matter what I meant, right? It matters to me what you think. Like, how are you experiencing that? Because the thing about art is like, you have 100 people look at the same poem and read it 100 different ways. You have 100 people look at a painting and get 100 different things from it. You can have 100 different people read this book and it bring up 100 different things for them. And so I think that's the thing that's been most, that's been coolest, is like seeing all the things that it brings up for people. Emails I get from folks who are like, I visited Monticello 30 years ago and nobody ever said anything about Sally Hemings. Nobody ever said anything about, you know, Thomas Jefferson as a slave owner. And now I'm thinking about all the other field trips I took to these places where what, you know, and thinking about what was mentioned and what wasn't. And, or like, you know, students who say that this is a sort of book that they, like have been waiting for, you know, for their own, and that they're like recommended to their teacher. And, you know, it's been really amazing. And I just feel grateful. I just feel it's not, you know, when you write a book, it's a very isolated process. It's a very long process and it's not guaranteed that, that anybody's going to read it. And so I feel grateful for the audience that it's gotten and for all the folks who are engaging with it.
For sure. I found it interesting about what you just said about how, you know, when you were 15 and wondering, you know, why are these monuments to these Confederate, you know, figures there? Because I came up in Richmond where, you know, even keeping up with the news, Richmond, the capital of the Confederacy, statues all throughout the, you know, downtown, all throughout the city. And, you know, it's right. There's been a movement to, you know, take these down. And of course, you know, like you said, of course, that's not an instant fix for racism. No one is saying that. And during this, you know, during the, this process where they were taking statues down, there was, you know, of course, people on Twitter like, well, this doesn't mean anything. This is just symbolism. And it's like, bro, if you're from like Connecticut or Oregon, I don't give a shit about what you have to say about this. You know what I mean? Like, like there are, you know, 10-year-old Black kids who are driving past this, who are riding past this 80-foot-tall of Robert statue of Robert E. Lee. Like, why is there this huge monument in this city that I grew up in? Of a man who doesn't think that I was, you know, I'm fully human. You know what I mean? Like that is psychological warfare. Like, you know, like you mentioned the iconography of the Confederates monuments were, there was a second surge during the Civil War. During the Civil Rights Movement where people were hyping up these Confederate figures to kind of, you know, let Black people know exactly what the morals of the city that they were in was. And, I guess I'm just rambling now, but I just wanted to touch on that. But the question that I have here for you is, you ended your book with a very powerful paragraph about how the question is, you know, not whether we should teach history in its full context, but if America is ready to reckon with history in its full context. Where do you think that our nation is in regards to that?
I think we're further along than we've been. But I think that, you know, and this is to your point, part of what happens is that at any moment of Black progress, there's backlash. Yes. And so, you know, Black progress during the Civil Rights Movement, they were like, okay, we're going to put up a whole bunch more statues of Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis to let you know where you stand. I mean, I think they just took down the bust of Nathan Bedford Forrest in the Tennessee, the capital of Tennessee. They didn't put, I think, I don't know the exact date, but they didn't put that statue up or that bust up in like 1878. They put it up in 1978, right? Like, so this is, Nathan Bedford Forrest is the founder of the Ku Klux Klan. Nathan Bedford Forrest massacred hundreds of Black soldiers who had surrendered already in the Union Army and just slaughtered them because he thought of any Black person fighting for the Union Army as a slave as part of an insurrection.
And 40 like, years ago, they were like, you know, we need ago. This guy.
Like, right. I mean, it's like the late
70s, right?
Right up until like 1980. And so they are not, the people who put those up are not unclear about like what it represents or what they're trying to say by it. They're very clear about it. And so I don't buy, to your previous point, like I don't buy this idea that like this stuff doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Or this stuff is not important. And we saw a lot about we saw a lot of that with Juneteenth becoming a national holiday. And it's like, look, Juneteenth, it's a both and, right? So we don't have to say that Juneteenth becoming a federal holiday doesn't matter. Because one, that does a disservice to the generations of Black activists, specifically Black activists in Texas, who've been fighting for this for decades. Right. And so I'm not going to say that this doesn't matter when like my elders and people who have been leading the struggle, people who were involved in the civil rights movement have been pushing for this for a really long time. Mm-hmm. And it also, I mean, it's important. It should have happened 156 years ago, but it's important that we have a holiday marking the end of one of the worst things we've ever done. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that it in and of itself is enough. That doesn't mean you don't still fight for voting rights. That doesn't mean you don't still fight to end mass incarceration. That doesn't mean you still don't fight for more equitable funding to schools and all, you know, the list goes on and on. And so I think we have to resist, you know, sometimes people just do things on Twitter just because, you know, it's Twitter. And like, you know, there's a lot of stuff I love about Twitter and a lot of stuff I don't.
Engagement
but,
is a drug for a lot
you
of
you know,
people.
I mean, yeah.
Literally. Literally,
it's a fix. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a fix. And I think it's easy to get on there and say, like, nobody asked for Juneteenth to be a federal holiday when, you know, this doesn't matter. That's such a narrow conception of like what social change and social progress looks yes. like. It's because the symbols inform the policy.
For sure.
They shape the stories that we tell.
For society.
And so I think that those are really
important. For society to progress, you've got to kill the old gods. And Confederate right. figures are the old gods down here. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
So I'm having a shorty in a little in like a month, right?
Is this your first one?
First kid, dog.
Man.
First kid, you know what I mean? Crazy.
Get ready. You got to.
He has no idea.
On. I'm super excited.
Gotta,
I'm too naive to be nervous, I think.
You got to pick out what your favorite dinosaur is so you can be ready.
There we go. BD, big dinosaur energy. You feel me? But, but anyway, do you plan on taking your children to these places? And if I were to take I was reading about this. I was like, I think it's important for my child to visit these locations. And what locations would you bring yours? I don't know if Angola is one of them I'm going to, but
yeah.
You know what I mean? You know, which location would you bring yours?
Yeah, I mean, I think all of these things you do in a way that is like scaffolded and like developmentally appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
But I absolutely, I mean, you know, part of it is that, I mean, if it was up to me, you know, we'd be taking road trips to Civil War battlefields on the weekend all the time. Yeah. But my wife is not, she's not about that life. I already.
Good for her. Good for her.
You know, right. You need some balance.
You need
dog.
That you balance in the family.
Every weekend. There's a lot of weekends in a year. 52
there's a lot of weekends. Maybe not every weekend. But she's, I already expended a lot of my marriage capital in the process of writing this book. So I'm in debt. I'm still
there
trying to get
go.
Out.
There we go.
Yeah, I mean, so what's interesting is that I actually went with my family to the Whitney.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I went to the Whitney first time in February of 2019 or January of 2019, in the winter of 2019, mm-hmm. and then Thanksgiving of 2019. So this would have been right before the pandemic. We went, we were celebrating my grandmother's 80th birthday. And part of that was that we all, so like all my family, all my cousins and everybody was there. And we all went to the Whitney together. And it was an incredible and powerful experience. I left it out of the book almost because it was almost like a thing that I kind of wanted to like keep for us. Mm. You know what I mean? Cause I was like, well, this is, you know, I'm here with my family at this place. But I think there's some things that you want to share with the world, and there are some things and some moments you want to keep for your family. But I remember being there, and you know, part of what I write in the epilogue is my grandmother talks about the way that she was educated about the history of slavery. And she, you know, she was like, yeah, we were told that Africans were savages. And we were told that, like, you know, basically they were told that slavery was good, right? Like that slavery that it rescued you from the savagery of Africa. And that you should be grateful to be in this place that gave you Christianity and civilization and all of this stuff. Because, you know, this is her going to school in the 40s, I guess, in the 40s in Florida. And so she had never encountered people talking about slavery in the way that they talk about it at the Whitney. She had never encountered the narratives and the voices of enslaved people themselves, like explaining for themselves what the experience was like. And so it was kind of, I mean, it's similar to the way that we experienced the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Let me just start saying the Blacksonian, because the other one is too long.
The Blacksonian.
But she was just like nobody ever taught me this, you know? And it's hard to describe what it's like to look at your 80-year-old grandmother and like see her learning like in real time, and seeing her also unlearning so much of what she had been taught about us and our people and our history. And I think the Whitney does remarkable work. You know, it's a museum, and they make specific artistic and curatorial choices. And I also have a lot of people I respect there's some people I respect who had a different experience than me at the Whitney, right? And they had a different experience than me at the Blacksonian. People have experienced these places in all sorts of ways. But for me, they are doing something that no other plantation in this country is doing. Unfortunately, they were really devastated by Hurricane Ida. And if folks are listening, they are also, they're looking for donations. You can go to their website and contribute.
We put that out after we put that out after the hurricane. We were reading the book when the hurricane happened, so we put that out there as well. Yes.
Yeah. It's so yeah. I would take my kids to the Whitney. I did take my kids to Whitney, but they were asleep in the stroller, so they don't remember. But I think that's a powerful place that is doing a lot. And honestly, I think Monticello is continuing to do really thoughtful work around this as well. Mount Pelier, where James Madison, what his plantation was, Mount Vernon, George Washington's plantation, all these places are revisiting the way that they tell the story and trying to tell it in a more honest and thoughtful way. And I think that's a good thing.
Well, Clint, thank you for being so generous with your time. Thank you for the book. It was a great discussion over the last month or so on the podcast, and we heard from a lot of people who really appreciate it. I think the kind of people who were not necessarily looking for books about the history of the legacy of slavery. So we really appreciate all the time. Sure. And we'd love to have you back on to just talk about sports and dumb shit.
You were at Davidson with Steph, right? During the Steph years?
That's my homie.
Yeah,
that's
we gotta have you back for sure. Yeah.
We gotta have it back. Well, you know, we could talk about what Steph was like in college. Mm-hmm. We could talk about is Zion gonna stay in New Orleans, or is he just
gonna get that rookie extension, and then he out after that, bro. God. So yeah, then I got out about that, four more five more years, but enjoy him.
Oh, Zion.
But for sure, we definitely gotta have you back on, broski.
For sure, man. Appreciate all right, you.
All right, our thanks to Clint for joining us. I feel like we're whiplashing people. Like, you know, we got Dino Cook-Offs and we have number one bestsellers on the pod.
Like that's our ethos right there.
Let's not bring up the Dino cook off no more, bro. That shit too embarrassing, nigga. I don't want to bring that shit up no more, dog.
You gotta learn from
this, cooked in the cook off, nigga. I was the motherfucking Dilophosaurus, nigga. I can't believe that shit. Woo, but go ahead.
A couple quick updates for everybody. The episode that drops on Monday will be our second annual Jenkins and Jones NBA preview special. We will be mentioning every team, even if it's only to say that we don't want to talk about your team. So it'll be comprehensive. It'll be funny. We're looking forward to it. So definitely check that one out. And then we're going to start reading. Tyler, what was it? Just give everyone a reminder again on the book and what chapters we're reading.
Yes, we are reading Dynasties, the 10 GOAT teams that shaped the NBA by the homie Marcus Thompson. We are going to read up to and including the Bill Russell Celtics chapter. It's four chapters. It's what's a dynasty, why are dynasties important, Mike and Lakers, then Russell Celtics.
So go grab that, get that. I'm gonna have to go to a bookstore because I went on Amazon and it's like he's selling that shit out, man. So yeah. They got it at Barnes and Noble near
really
me.
Good fucking book. It's fun.
Yeah,
as
so grab that. We're gonna start reading that for Thursday's episode next week. But I think other than that, is that it? Anything else?
Bye.
Peace.
Bye.
Bye.